All right, gentlemen, this conference is being recorded. We have Scott on board. Scott, we want to welcome you. I don't know how long you've been in the background, but I think you are hearing from the comments from people and the kind of general camaraderie and fun we have here. We have an amazing fellowship. We're already in our 8th week of a cycle that is it will go for about 21 weeks. So we're already into the We Agnostics chapter. We're on page 53 of our journey, which is about 103 pages, so we're really halfway through the big book reading. I have to pay credit to Scott because I didn't know how to do this. I wouldn't know how to do this if it wasn't for Scott. It was Scott, who I met in a meeting some 8 years ago, that actually that was the second time I met Scott. I've known Scott for a long time, and it was in that face-to-face meeting that I saw that he was a big book bucky and learned from the big book and used the big book and went page by page through the big book and was able to call out the most important messages of the big book. Scott's also very, very dedicated to step work, and I think I hope I'm doing my best to emulate what I've learned from Scott to give over to the guys. So he's definitely in the Masorah. He's in the link all the way back to Moshe Masinai as far as how a man can come from the midst of the deepest, darkest days of his addiction into the beautiful light of recovery and connection to our higher power, to Hashem. So without further ado, hold on, a little more ado. You should know, everybody should know the call is being recorded. Scott will be speaking to us for a period of time, and then we'll have some questions and answers. So you're welcome to refrain from giving over your name if you're concerned about your anonymity. Otherwise, let's proceed. Scott, welcome aboard. How you doing?
Thanks.
Welcome, Scott.
Thank you. I guess the easiest way I thought about to cover during the time I've got to speak is to basically outline, Bill talks about the program is simple, not easy. It's just outline. I get called frequently during the day from sponsees looking for clarity on a wide range of things. And it's really, that's really, the biggest thing that helps keep me sober, because it keeps me focused on the primary tools we have at our disposal.
All right, I'm sorry to interrupt here. I forgot to do one thing. I need to do a background noise mute.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a master mute. That means you'll have to do a star 6 to unmute yourself. Everybody, please stay muted for the time being until we go into the Q&A. So here we go. All right, everybody would please appreciate remaining muted except Scott to star 6 to unmute yourself. If you have background noise and you can talk on, please mute yourself. All right, Scott, go ahead. Scott, you may have to do a star 6 yourself to unmute yourself.
Okay, did that work?
It did. We hear you loud and clear.
Okay. So when I receive a call and a person starts to dial in on whatever the issue is, the first thing I start to do is really identify, help them identify what's going on. So page 84, y'all have probably already covered that. Basically, the program helps us learn how to monitor for when we get twisted up. Because the program's insight for me was that when I get twisted up, there's nothing wrong around me. It's where does the... this is just a quiz since y'all have been rolling through this. Where does the program tell us that the problem centers? Oh, yeah, you can't. So anyway, because everybody's muted, you can't answer. Page 23 tells us that the problem centers in my mind. In the cognitive illusion I lived with prior to getting recovery is whenever I ran into a problem, I really thought the problem was somewhere around me. I thought it was my wife. I thought it was my job. I thought it was my car. I thought it was the other person. I thought it was lack of money. I thought it was the future. I thought it was the past. I thought it was my childhood. There was always something other than me that was the problem. And I would concede, I'm part of the problem. But then I quickly get back to the problem was out there. And the program really clearly articulates on page 23 that the problem centers in my mind. The reason I'm a sick guy and I'm in this program is because I have a peculiar bent to my mind. And that is that when I do my best thinking, I come up with self-destructive things to do and say. When I really sit down and I figure it out and I think on it and I really work on it, it's astonishing how not constructive the things I come up with are. The reason is the program tells me that I'm selfishly self-centered, which is ironic because if I were selfishly self-centered, you would think that I would come up with things that would be constructive for myself. And that's the beauty of my addiction unfolding, is I started to come to clarity, come to my truth, and it's on page 30 that I have to concede to my innermost self that this is my deal. I don't figure it out. I concede it to my innermost self. They're very careful about that language. That I have a mind that's sick, that has some real issues, and the essence of it for me is, again, when I think on something, I work on it, I process it, I come up with some really self-destructive conclusions. Interestingly enough, there are also conclusions I love to come up with on my solitary thinking. I don't need to check in with people. I say, well, it's obvious. And usually they're accompanied with a sense of fairness, a sense of justice, a sense of me being right. You know, I put my cape on and I'm flying through the air. I was meeting the other day, and it's great when you can see this in somebody talking. I was talking to a barista, you know, cooked with the requisite tattoos and body piercing, and she was describing she had an argument with her boyfriend, and he locked her out of the house, and so, you know, the normal person would go get a, you know, maybe the worst case would be a brick. She hopped in her pickup truck and drove through the front of the house. And I laughed because I identified, I understood that the thinking that can make you think something's a great idea in the moment. The essence of what's going on then is, since I can't trust my thinking, I have to find something that I can trust. It's really important. I cannot get this deal if I'm still trusting my thinking. So the first thing I get is I get a call, and the guy tells me a situation. He's twisted up, and it's always something major, you know. You know, my wife left me. My children turned out to be rotten or in jail, or, you know, I mean, it's big stuff. But, the person's twisted up. And so we go back, we revisit the deal, and we say, well, where's the center of the problem? Well, the problem's in my mind, right? That's fundamental, because if I don't start there, I'm going to start doing some heavy-duty thinking, right? That's what I like to do. I like to wake up in the middle of the night when it's really quiet, and I get into some heavy-duty thinking. That's the stuff that's going to take me out. In the beginning of We Agnostics says that, it's page 44, where it says, I've got a choice, I've got an either or. I'm either going to continue to really think about stuff, or I'm going to give it up. And what they call the give it up is they call a spiritual life. And a spiritual life is just me not thinking. So the idea of this process of me thinking for myself, they try a number of ways to label, but the chapter We Agnostics culminates, and it moves through an argument that you all have just covered, and one of the most beautiful things is on page 49, where they give us a another either or. And the chapter kind of works in either or. They're trying to help us understand. David has a wonderful with his A and W moments, which kind of works into that off page 46. But page 49 says, either I'm going to regard myself as an intelligent agent. In other words, my intelligence is being used by my higher power as a spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation as life unfolds. Or I'm going to use my human intelligence as the last word, the Alpha and the Omega. Basically, I'm going to figure it out. And the figure-it-out mode is the really dangerous mode because I'm using my mind, but what I don't know is I'm using the mind for my selfish, self-centered perspective, which puts me, which accentuates the sick mind, which they talk about in step two, where they say that the deal here is we're going to be restored to sanity. Now, but page 53 then gives me something I can hang on to because it says I have to fearlessly face the proposition that God is everything or God is nothing. That's the clincher. So somebody calls up and they have a bad event happen. And it, literally this happens. I get these calls every day regularly. And if you go down this journey together with your fellows, this is the deal. And this is what really is the help others that helps ourselves because we stay in the Son Spirit. And it is that... somebody calls up and I say, where's the real problem? Problems in my mind, page 23. What do I know about everything around me? Everything around me is all God all the time. Page 53 tells me that's the deal. So now I've got my bearings straight. Now I can start to work on what the issue is, which is how to get clarity on what God's doing in a process, how to surrender to the process, how to get to the next right thing to do. The judo move here is always to let go and let God. It's never to add, it's always to subtract. The program is to remove the obstacles. It's a lot like a breathing process. All the esophagus, the lungs, everything's intact. We're simply trying to remove obstacles that have been placed there by my thinking. I've placed the obstacles in the way. There are obstacles that, as David was talking about earlier, are our comfort zone. We're very comfortable with, even though not in our best interest. David, I know there's some time constraints here, and I want to be respectful of that.
Well, I appreciate that. I'd still like to, I mean, you're just driving home some major clarity, major points. I know the Hevra appreciates you're referencing to page numbers as well. So keep at it for another 5 minutes if you can or more, and then we'll open up to questions till the top of the hour. So we got another 30 minutes, so we're good to go.
Okay, so let me go a little bit further on that. So when I introduce that, the next thing I ask is I say, okay, you've identified the feelings you've had. We've identified the problems in the mind. We've identified that it's all God all the time. When you identified it, what was the prayer that you said? Right? It's very interesting because there are a few short prayers that are worth memorizing and are very useful. The primary thing they say we're looking for is resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear. And they have placed... And basically what happens, it's a very simple program. I'm here to live in the present. The present is where God's at. The past is something I make up. It's an image. I connect 5 to 10 to 1,000 dots out of billions of dots that I could. So what happens is I've created the past in my mind, and that's where resentments come from. And they have a very powerful resentment prayer, which some people call the sick man prayer, and I really insist on everybody memorizing it. So if a person says it's a resentment, I say, okay, what's the resentment prayer? And they say, well, I didn't pray it. And I say, well, why don't you go ahead and off the phone and pray about it and then get back. Because job of a sponsor is to help people connect to their higher power. It's not to be their higher power. Something my sponsor really helped me understand, because at first you're gung-ho and you want to do some cool stuff, but it's like dealing with children. You're going to help people find their higher power. So I just say, hey, and some people say, well, I don't know where the resentment prayer is, right? So I'm not a librarian either. I'm not God. I'm not a librarian. So, you know, then they get a little resentment towards me, which is okay. They go back. The sick man prayer, for those who are new to the program, or the resentment prayer, is a four-part prayer on page 67. The first part says, this is a sick man. And I always add to that and recommend that the people I work with say, this is a sick man doing the best he can. One of the propositions that's important to get to, and one of the biggest stumbling blocks in this program, is when people have to accept that people are doing the very best they can. When I get there, when I get that first part, this is a sick man, and that's what they're summarizing. If you read the paragraph before, they say, we treat people like somebody has an illness. You don't expect a cripple to run. The idea is everybody's doing the best they can, and now I'm moving to the next part. What can I do to be helpful is part two. Third part becomes very naturally out of once I've identified what I can do to be useful, it's made that which makes a 180-degree turn in my perception. Now I'm looking at the next part, which is God help me not be angry, and then finally I move to the part, hey, it's your universe, not mine, right? God's created the play, the theater, assigned the lines. I'm simply here to show up and do God's will. Now I'm connected, so as we move along in the process of the phone call, now we talk about, well, is there an amends necessary? Do I need to own it? Amends are very different than forgiveness. It's a process where I'm just owning my stuff. I'm being real. I'm no longer the addict living a double life. I'm coming out and I'm saying, hey, I got a little tangled up in this deal. I just want to own it. If there's anything I can do to make it right, I'd like to do it. Boom. Real simple, not big ego involved. The next thing I'm going to do is move along to what I can do to be helpful to others. Well, I've already identified it's been part of the prayer, right? That's dealing with the past. The future is dealt with in the fear prayer, which is the other big topical area. And page 68 deals with fear, which most of us have a hard time identifying resentment until we're in the program, but we've all identified fear. If we haven't felt fear, we probably wouldn't be on this phone call today, because we're masters at coming up with fantasies of how terrible this thing can look if I don't show up with my cape. And there are prayers addressing that in there. I can spend a little bit more time in the Q&A, but I think we're at the five-minute time you recommended, David.
All right. Well, good. Well, all right, Hevra, you're welcome to unmute yourself now, but do respect the whole fellowship here, that if you do know you have background noise, please limit your time on to ask a question. We'll go in order. We'll actually start with a question because I invited Hevra to send me their own questions. And the one of our fellowship members says, hi, I heard that many people that recover are struggling financially. I own a small business. I was very successful. I was in, and he puts in his own text here, control. I was in control. I managed the operations, and then I found recovery. I personally feel that I have a big fear to go back to success, fear to get control again and edge God out, and for sure to lose sobriety. So he says, I heard that you're a person that recovered and also successful at work. How are you able to keep sobriety? And number two says, in my success time, I was extremely busy. I can't imagine myself helping others or taking the recovery as my daily task more than an hour a day. And sincerely signed. So did you get that, Scott?
Yeah. If you kind of narrowed it down, it's two parts. Right.
Really trying to understand how, one can, he has a fear of success because of his recognition that when he was had success in his business, that he was in a control mode and he didn't want to get back into that. so that's a fear of success because of that. And then trying to understand how to juggle going back into that kind of work mode and still being doing everything you need to do in recovery, take the calls, make the calls, et cetera.
Good. Okay. So those are great questions to dial in, and those are the real living deal, which is once I get the fact that it tells us that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. It actually states in the big book that that is the key requirement that we're going to have to pass through to realize that any life, not just an addict's life, run on self-will can hardly be a success. Right? Which is a little astonishing because we look around and we see people and we see them busting it and making things happen and we go, wow, he's a success. The first thing is, the only way I'm going to get that requirement is not just read through it and nod my head like most of us do as we read the big book, but really say, wait a minute, am I on board with that or not? If I'm on board with that, the only way I can get on board with that is to redefine what I mean by success. This program is fundamentally, to me, about experiencing the highest continuous supreme joy that I can experience. It actually wasn't my shenanigans that brought me into the program as much as my misery. It's the misery that's gone. That's why I always tell people every day is a holiday, right? I mean, you know, on one level, if I can see and pee and walk, it's a holiday. On another level, if I'm exempt from the misery that brought me into this, that drove my addictions, that's the key. And what drives that is that self-will. The only way I can experience joy is when I'm not trying to get my way. Here's the beauty, here's the judo move. If I've surrendered and I'm working because it's God's will, God's leadership, I don't have to worry because I know God's already assigned how much I'm going to make. If God wanted me to have $1 billion tomorrow, I'd have $1 billion tomorrow. So I'm no longer put in a position where I'm viewing that I'm paying my bills. In the past, I had a delusion that it was my drive and my control that drove outcomes. Actually, all the time, it was God's dictate. It was God's power at work, and I was just calling it my power. It's like I was riding down a river going 80 miles an hour with a huge current, and because I've got my foot in the water, I'm thinking I'm making it happen. It was delusional in one aspect of what drove my misery, which brings to the second part, which when I got in recovery, I had the same thing. You know, my wife said, I thought this was a program where you worked with other people. And I said, you know, I don't want to get carried away here. I want to have a balanced life. And then I started doing a little bit of work. And then I talked to my sponsor. I said, you know, this is starting to take like an hour a day. He said, is your income going down? I said, no, kind of, it's going up. And he said, well, go with it. And, you know, I would say probably a third or a half of my time is program stuff. I really look at it. It's God's planet. It's God's income. It's God's outflow. All I'm trying to do is dial on where my highest usefulness is, and it's just a connection of all God all the time. So I'm getting myself out of the identification that I'm driving the outcome, which the beauty about working with others is it helps gain that trust. You increase your trust and faith that you're placing the outcome in God's hands.
Wow. All right. Okay, Kevra, let's open it up. You're welcome to ask Scott, as you can see, any question. He's certainly equipped to answer them.
Hey, Scott, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Scott, I'm fairly new to sponsoring people. And I have a fifth-step call coming up soon. I'd like to get your opinion on the best way I can be of service in the fifth-step call, what to say, what not to say, what to point out, what not to point out, and that kind of question.
Cool. So what I do on fifth-step is I basically start out and I read pages 72 through 75. We just kind of go through it aloud, and that kind of sets it up. I stop after it says we pocket our pride and go to it on 75. The big thing I want to get to is on page 73, there are two paragraphs that deal with the double life. And really what I'm trying to do, and the beauty of this fifth step, is there are two things that are going on. You know, the fifth step tells us we're going to get to the exact nature of our sickness. And the first thing that's going to happen is to get there, and a great guy, Chuck, says we're going to uncover, which is, first of all, by being real, which is the hardest thing we have in recovery. Being honest. It tells us, page 58, we're going to spend our lives becoming honest with other people. So I'm trying to really be real. I'm trying to get real. So we're going to talk about that on page 73. Going to emphasize this is that first step in this journey. Because if it's all God all the time, reality is where I'm going to make that connection. And a lot of what I'm doing is I'm feeling very disconnected. My misery, my disease, my addiction, I'm isolated. I'm feeling like in a really dark, unconnected room. The way I'm going to get connected is I'm going to get connected through being real, through becoming honest. And I'm going to spend my whole life becoming honest because I just have a tendency to kind of spin it, right? So I'm going to be honest. That's the first time I introduce. The next thing is now we've got the information. And I go through, and we're going to deal with three things, resentment first, fear second, and the third thing we're going to deal with is sex conduct. And what I do is I don't go through every resentment, take about 8 hours, right? But what I do is I say, give me your biggest, baddest resentment. And they go, well, you mean right now? I mean your whole life. Who have you really, by this time, that resentment's gone away. And inevitably, in 9 out of 10 cases, it's going to be about mom and dad, right? It's going to be about my parents. There was something in my childhood that just didn't work. Because the reason I'm isolated now is I'm miserable. If I'm miserable, I'm not blaming it on me. Page 23 actually tells it's me. So now I'm going to go ahead, and they're going to put out the four columns, right? Column 1, mom or dad. Column 2, what they did. Column 3, how it affected me. And column 4, I'm astonished how, as a 6-year-old, I could have done anything that was my part. Now it's opened up. Now we can start to dig in there. Fear process, basically similar, then we go through the sex conduct. The generally, a fifth step should only take 2 to 3 hours because people don't have enough, they don't have enough sit. Yeah, what you want to do is you want, after that first resentment, you've identified it, to go to the second resentment, have them do it. Now they'll be able to fill in the fourth column. And then if they're still having a little tough time, have them do the third one. Have them do the fourth one. You're having them, you're helping them learn how to do it themselves. The idea is, after the fifth step, it tells us that we're going to go back and we're going to spend 1 hour by our time seeing if we put everything together correctly. And I want them, when they go back that 1 hour and they review all their other resentments, to go, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, because the fourth column is really the same. I'm playing God by being the judge. And everybody has a certain way. That's how we're getting to the exact nature of our wrong, right? I'm playing God. That's what I do.
Good.
And then the sex conduct is the thing that everybody fears, and that's not a big deal. You know, that's the part that we don't want to talk about, but everybody puts it, now they go, now the part I dread, and you just look at it and you go, yeah, well, you see a better idea. They go, yeah. You go, okay, cool. Boom. That's not a big deal. The big deal is the resentment. And then, I'd say it's 75% resentment, 25% fear, and hardly any on sex conduct.
Thank you, Scott.
Okay,
good. All right, gentlemen, any other questions? Let's ask some more questions about the program, the process, the proper way of thinking, or the new design for living.
Is it Chaim?
Yes.
It's Rocklin. How are you?
Good.
I had a couple questions. One, Scott had mentioned about some prayers, but he didn't mention the prayers. He talked about the resentment prayer. Is that just the serenity prayer? Is that the resentment prayer? Is there a different prayer than what's written as the basic prayers in the big book?
The resentment prayer is the one written in the big book. And as once we start, you know, the first prayer in the big book that's mentioned is on the top of page 59, right, as we start to roll through the deal, right? And as you go through, there are little short prayers all the way through. And people don't see them as prayer, but when it says we ask, that's a prayer. That's a sign, hey, here comes a prayer. On page 67, there is a specific resentment prayer. We're discussing in that section as we prep for five, right? In the step four, as we start to uncover and discover what a resentment looks like, to give us prayers. And so the first prayer is page 67, and that's in the big book. And by the way, anything that can't be squared with the big book here, you know, I'm just wrong.
So far, you're batting 1,000. So the one that asked the question, do you have the big book handy?
I don't have the big book handy, sorry.
All right. So, Scott, refer to it. Scott, go ahead and give it over. You're right, page 67.
Top of page 67, there's a four-part prayer, and it'll start with quotations, "This is a sick man." The next prayer that's really critical is the fear prayer. The fear prayer is on the next page. And let me tell you, I do a little bit just because of personal experience. If y'all are familiar with the 11th step, the 11th step tells us that we're going to pray only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. Right? Over and over again, the big book says we are not going to pray for ourselves. Over and over again. Why? Because that's what I've been doing all my life. So, you know, you take a selfish, self-centered guy whose insanity is rooted in his inability to think about anybody's self. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, am I self-centered or is it just me? Right? My insanity is dialed in. The last thing I need to do is have a prayer life that's rooted in me praying for me. So it says praying only, that only is very important. Only for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. Now, in the fear prayer tells me, right, it says we can pray for fear, and it says that what we're going to do is we're going to ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. The challenge there is if I start any prayer out like, you know, first of all, remove something or make me not be angry. See, that's the beauty. The sick man prayer, the resentment prayer, doesn't say remove my anger first. It says, this sick guy doing the best he can. What can I do to be helpful? The third part of the prayer is, God, remove my anger. Right? Because I've already established I'm looking at the world wrong. So in the fear prayer, I recommend people use the stuff on 68, which is, there's a sentence in there that says, we trust infinite God rather than finite self. So I just say this. Listen, I'd rather trust infinite you rather than finite me. Now I'm a whole long ways along the fear process, right? I'm dealing with infinite here. So the second thing I say is the next thing, which is very profound. I say, I'm only in the world to play the role that you assign me. Now I can say, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Boom. Right? I haven't started off on a selfish footing. That's all stuff that's on page 68, but that's what I recommend the sponsees for the prayer there.
Good.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Please, Valvo, go ahead.
Thank you. Hello, Scott. Thank you for coming on the call. I really got a lot of what you said, especially the prayer stuff. I want to ask you a question. I personally feel so bogged down in my unmanageability due to my character defects and my other addictions. I was wondering if you could say a few words of strength about dealing with unmanageability when a person is multiply addicted and bogged down by other character defects and other addictions.
Yeah, basically, all fundamentally, life is unmanageable. That's the big bait and switch. I told my sponsor. I said, what a screwball program. You know, you come in and you say, oh, yeah, I'm a mess. I'm powerless over lust. My life's unmanageable. And then you find out, like, you sign up thinking that means your life's going to turn out to be manageable. It's not. What's going to happen is it's simply going to be managed by God, which is always going to feel out of control to my crazy brain. The other addictions that we have, which, you know, I'm nuts about espresso. You know, we're just addictive personalities. We jump from one to another, are all symptomatic. It's just symptomatic that I'm not okay riding on the infinite power of God. I get kind of weirded out. I want clarity. I want to know the future. I want to know where it's going, and I want comfort. When things are going great, I go, good. I don't want them to change now. I lock in. And my sponsor always helps me, and the critical thing that he dials me in on to deal with the unmanageability of life is to increase my conscious contact, step 11, through prayer and meditation. That's the whole program comes down to, I'm glad you brought up prayer right at the front end. The whole program comes down to all of this theoretical unmanageability is there to improve our conscious contact with God. It's just a knock on the door saying, you know, just get closer here. Get closer, get closer. Every bump in the road is only a way for me getting closer. And as soon as I'm getting closer, it won't be a bump in the road.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate what you said. I will take it to heart and internalize it. Thank you.
Scott, this is Brant from California. Good to hear your voice again. We met about 5 years ago, if you recall.
In California? Or
no, in Dallas. You introduced me to David, one of my first sponsors.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
I know I speak for myself, but I know many men on this call have issues with our lovely and dear wives who we've disappointed, you know, once, certainly, if not several times. And maintaining that peace in the home, maintaining that relationship, I know I've struggled with being honest with her, probably more so than anyone else, and, you know, have gotten discovered more than once, even in recovery, because of the insidious nature of our disease. And just wanted to see if you had anything to share with us about how we can better handle that relationship. And if you've indeed struggled with your wife and being honest about what was going on in your head, how you went about doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a critical area. The first thing is the resentment prayer is awesome, and any wife can really help drive the proper use of that, because first thing that's going to happen, a lot of our growth, a lot of our spiritual growth is going to be when there's a tangle with the most important person in our lives, which is our wife. That's how, you know, Hashem's missile to my head is going to come through that. The second thing is the program is, and this is where it's very important that I work with my sponsor, and I do work with my sponsor quite a bit on this topic, where it's important that I not use my wife. So, for example, some people use their wives without realizing it as a place like an accountability partner. They use them to make themselves have power. They use themselves to assuage themselves of guilt. It's very important that I love my wife, that I not use my wife, which means I've actually got to communicate what's favorable to peace in the home, like you were talking about. So I talk to my sponsor. It's clear as a bell that a double life is a dangerous place to be. And the nice thing in the program is I can lead with weakness and I can be real about stuff. There's some things in here that that we're just going to have to carry with ourselves, that we're not going to unload on our wives. And my biggest recommendation here would be, as a situation develops, stay close to your sponsor And there'll be times where full disclosure is good in a trust builder. There's sometimes that full disclosure is really a dumping, and it's not healthy.
Brant, is that
connect
to that?
Thanks, Scott.
Scott, you know, we see that you know, oftentimes that men are like you said, using their wives. I try to help the guys answer the basic question: what do our wives want? I mean, what is it that they're seeking from us? Are they really looking for us to be sober? You know, a lot of guys at the beginning said, "Yeah, oh yeah, they just want us to be sober," and maybe even a lot of wives would say that. But really, what they want us to be is a mensch, and you know what that means. It's behaviors that go that are the percolate out of our change, our new design to living. You know, the generosity and the tolerance and so on. So that's what they're really looking for. Why? I still haven't been able to answer the question why they harp on. I mean, imagine because they see the blow to them as the one of our acting out, and so they think, without having any other tools, that that's what they need to zone in on, you know, zero in on. So, I mean, that's what I hear from my experience. And thus, the importance for them, if they're willing, they can't be pushed, but willing to seek out support that they can get from Essanon groups or the Guard Your Eyes groups led by my wife and others.
That's where I was going to next is I'm a sick guy. So if somebody voluntarily got in a relationship with me, you know, I hate to take my wife's inventory, but that ain't right. Right? I mean, you go, this guy's not connecting on intimacy, but he likes a big time, right? What happens is actually a very strange thing. As I grow in recovery, it's been a huge challenge in my marriage. All of a sudden, my wife, you know, addicts really invite women that are very controlling into their lives. They call it codependent. And my recommendation is as joy comes in and the friction comes in because all of a sudden you're less dependent on that person, and sometimes full disclosure is an attempt on their part to increase dependency in an unhealthy way. The recovery program like David's talking about for spouses is a wonderful way to help get a new dynamic in the relationship.
Okay.
Chaim, I have a question.
Yes, please.
Okay. You started off with the premise that we're, you know, that this disease is in our mind, and we need to no longer speak the path and connect with God and ask only for what He wants from us. So I kind of get confused sometimes. Starting off with the idea that my mind is sick, how do I know to trust my mind when I believe that God is communicating to me, that this is what He wants of me? And not say, well, maybe that's just another selfish interpretation of what He wants of me.
So that's the reason we've got sponsors. That's the reason we're connected in meetings, right? It's a great question. It is the bell ringer thing for the rest of our lives. And the big book talks about gradually, very slowly, we're learning to live on a plane of intuition. But basically what we're doing is there are certain things. I love the movie Beautiful Mind. You know, here's a guy who's very intelligent, and it just took him a long time to realize he was seeing things that weren't there. Right? I've learned, my sponsors really helped me to look at my motive as actions unfold and my motives are about me, I should be very skeptical of what I'm seeing. That's more and more our process of recovery has gone from obviously the insane things to something that then you think, well, this is a pretty good idea. And I check in with him and he says, well, what's your motive? As soon as we start to unfold the motive, and that's why the four parts we look for in page 84, we look for resentment, fear, dishonesty, which we've talked about, and finally, I'm glad you brought this up, selfishness. When my motive is selfish, it's going to tell me, hey, you're okay here. You're in good zone. This is exactly what should be happening. This is clear that God's telling you to do this, right? You're on a great spiritual plane. But that's where I check in with my sponsor and we kind of look at the motive of the deal. And the weird thing is when I get my motive clear, it doesn't mean that I'm not doing something very similar to it, but I'm in a great space about it. I have joy. I have connectivity. People feel that way around. They notice a different Scott going on. They're not getting the retaliatory selfishness cycled in.
I think that Heather could share with you. Maybe someone can share with you one of the mantras that I try to give over to the guys, a number of different mantras to have in mind, just like memorizing these prayers as well. And what is the mantra that we use, Hevra, to help with our understanding of our motives?
What's your perception of motives?
Well, could, indeed, you're right. I do say at the very beginning that my aim is to help a man ask to become more aware of his perceptions and motives. I tell them, Scott, right from the very beginning, that's what we're going to do. We're just going to learn how to become more aware of our perceptions and motives. And then I think you heard one of the other men say the mantra that we keep in mind before we sort of take one step, raise one hand, or one word comes out of my mouth, we say...
For my servant.
That's right. Did you hear that, Scott?
Yeah, that's great.
Who am I serving now? If we would just go into every situation before we say one word, you know, react, respond, whatever, take one step or make one choice, we ask, "Who am I serving now?" And I say that's the red flag. If I'm honest with myself and I see, well, I'm serving self, then I really I should be aware that I'm walking into a minefield right now. I may be able to navigate it and may be the right thing to do, but too many times out of 100 in my life as an addict, my disease manifested itself from when to the time of serving to the time. So
I have
a short question for Scott, if possible, Mr. Mayor.
Okay,
you touched upon the, step 11, praying only for the knowledge of his will. For us and the power to carry that out. Now, you know, I know we shouldn't really pray to win a lottery and this. What's wrong with simply praying to God? But we should have the basic needs we have, basic needs, you know, shelter and food in order to serve God. I mean, we have basic needs, you know, and our family should be healthy and all these things just in order that we should be able to carry on with our service. Is there anything wrong with that?
I'm going to only refer to the big book. The big book thinks it's a dangerous spot for an addict to go to. I avoid controversy at any time possible. If a person's praying, that's good. Praying for my own stuff never worked, and I ultimately came to a conclusion that God was more interested in changing me than me changing God, right? So, you know, the idea in my recovery journey has been that prayer and meditation is a tool for conforming me to God's will, not God to my will.
Hi, this is Yaakov, the founder of Guard Your Eyes. I just wanted to thank you, Scott, for coming on this call. It really means a lot to us all. Thanks for being David Chaim's sponsor. We're all interconnected, and you're helping David Chaim ultimately is helping all the guys on this call, really. So we're really all owe a big gratitude to you. And I just wanted to get on the call and say thank you, Scott, for coming on tonight. Actually, cool. It's night in Israel, but it's noontime in America. Thanks again.
Thank you,
Scott. Thank you, Yaakov.
Wow, thanks, Yaakov, for coming on board. You're right. I owe a great deal of gratitude to Scott for his helping me. When I get twisted up and sort these matters out and bring it and share it. And, you know, just what you're seeing, and there's nobody on this call, nobody, that can't do what I do. I'm not any big guy. All I'm doing is just passing down a tradition from sponsor to sponsee. And it's exciting, and it's worthwhile, and it really does impact in our little Dalai Lamas, and our families and our communities, and ultimately the whole world. So pass it forward. You've heard that phrase before. That's all I'm doing. I'm nobody special. I just pass it forward. And hopefully Scott would attest to the same thing from his sponsor, passing it forward.
It's Aaron D. Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Okay. I have a quick question relating to something you said earlier, which in regards to oneself. Is it important at any point in time to get your wife involved in these support groups if she's adamant that she doesn't want to go to such a support group and be involved?
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, here's when we get into recovery, the people around us notice it more than we notice it. My experience was I just felt like everybody started to finally behave and do the right things. Actually, I was just dialing in the fact that they were doing the right things all along, and it was my critical nature that was getting removed. So what happens now is I start to experience joy and peace, and what actually happens is people around me start to wonder what's up. Now, some people look and say, you know, he can go to hell. I don't like him because he's having a fun time. They just get a little reaction that way, and that's okay. They'll stay in that space for as long as they want to. But what actually happens over time is there's a tradition that says attraction, not promotion. And what happens when I'm happy, I'm doing the deal, I'm experiencing peace, joy, serenity, and it becomes compelling to everybody around me. And my children are funny. They said, you know, too bad there isn't just like a recovery program for normal people, right? I mean, they're so impressed by the effect that I tell them, I say, you know why there's not a program for normal people? And I say, why? And they say, because normal people won't do the things that we have to do.
Wow.
You know, we got a gun in our heads. Normal people aren't going to sign up. Can you imagine going somewhere and having to say, well, for you to do this deal, you have to write on a piece of paper every bad thing you've done. They're really small membership. But so you keep working the deal, and your wife will ultimately, I've never seen it fail, just on polls, she goes, wow, that's pretty cool stuff. And she starts to slide over there. But when they start to see the stuff that we end up doing, my children are in their 20s. They're already not interested in writing everything down on a piece of paper they've done wrong.
Got it.
Wow.
Thank you very much. I certainly hope that that's the case. The fear was really coming from the fact that, you know, it's only happened once or twice, but that's the first thing that's thrown when there's an argument. You know, you're lucky I stayed with you, something along those lines. So that's why I was asking.
You know what, Aaron? Just
yep.
Say you're right. You're right. I'm very lucky. Does it ever hurt? I've never been in an argument where I've told somebody you're right and they get mad that I told them you're right. Unless they think I'm being sarcastic, of course. But to be sincerely, say, you know what, honey, you're right. I am right. Okay, so what you know, what Scott and is proposing, what I'm hearing is that I just have to keep working my program, and if as a consequence of it my wife goes into the program, gezinta hey, I've done enough in my lifetime to manage people, and certainly my wife being the top of my list. It's a contradiction for me to proclaim my pathway in the recovery program and at the same time use it as a tool to badger her to go into it. That's the biggest proof positive that I haven't changed. In fact, I'm probably getting worse. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense.
Okay, all right. So, you know, letting go and letting God by definition means literally letting God run the show. And seeing, you know, one of the most beautiful things for me, the most joyful, meaningful parts of my life now, and why I love recovery and sobriety so much. You hear me talk about being about positive sobriety and that kind of joy, and I learned a lot of that from Scott, was being able to appreciate how the universe is unfolding right before me. It's like magic, and I get to witness it. Wow, I'm the luckiest man alive. And it may not always be roses. Sometimes thorns unfold in the growth of life around me. But that's okay, too. That's what it takes. That's what, not only what it takes, that's what God wants. And I'm here for my little 60, 70, 80, 120 years in this little vestibule to get to witness this. Wow, I'm signed up for it. I live a life of inspiration. Not because there's something, because the Red Sea is splitting every day, but because my heart gets to beat. And I get to walk, and I get to pee, and I get to look through my eyes. That's joy. That's real inspiration. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. So it's much more independently driven.
It's a combination. It's not only independently driven. Rabbi David Aaron shared with us that because we're all have a tzelem elokim, a spark of God within us, where's that spark come from? Sources, Kabbalistic sources, teach us that spark is comparable to a ray of light. And even though a ray of light may be zooming through the universe at 186,000 miles per second, it's still and will always and can never deny that its source is the sun. And the Kabbalistic sources use the sun as a mashal for HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And just knowing that, yes, I'm independent because I'm a spark, but I'm all a ray of light, but I'm just like everybody else, like you. And everybody else on this call, and everybody on the street that's also a ray of light. So I'm independent, and I'm dependent, and I'm united and unified. My joy comes from recognizing that we all have a mission, we all have a purpose, we can all support one another, and we're here to do a turn this. You know, God created a universe, a chaotic universe, and filled it with imperfect beings. And he expects us and gives us the tools in order to perfect it. What can be more awesome than that?
So we're essentially we're partners with God.
100. There it is. And with one another.
Interdependent.
Interdependent. Yes, much better word. Thanks. All right. Scott, I appreciate you letting me jump in on that one.
Cool.
Okay. All right. I know we've gone over the hour. I don't know if anybody has another question or if Scott's even got time for another question, but I'll open it up. Anybody else? Scott, you're making people sigh now. Isn't that awesome?
Well, Scott, I'll ask you one more question. As a former money manager, do you find it difficult to implement, you know, the steps given your occupation?
Somebody asked a great question earlier about getting back into work and that control thing. I found that in my third, fourth years of recovery, I would sit down and, you know, my brain, I'd be in a good recovery mode, and I'd sit down to analyze things, and I'd start feeling that twisted up, that creepy crawly feeling. And I thought, what the heck is going on here? And what was going on is I was using my brain for a process that God had in mind, but I was experiencing it as if it was me doing it rather than feeling the connection of God doing that. Oh. I had to really work that, and when I started getting creepy crawly quick, just get away from it for a little while, chill out, walk around the block or whatever, it's gotten pretty good now. you're basically trying to find a way to surrender yourself into the stream of God's unfolding universe and stay connected with that. But I think it'll always be a challenge anytime that I get into something that invites me to do it as if it's just me doing it. Because the lust shows right up. I feel kind of that creepy thing that you feel before you kick into lust. You get kind of yucky, crawly, and I'm like, oh, okay, here it comes. I'm in a bad space with respect to how I'm doing my work. I hope that's helpful.
I wasn't strong enough. I had to quit just because it wasn't working. But that's why I asked the question. But it's good to hear you were able to overcome that.
Listen, Arne, that's a great question. What's so exciting about this program is we learn new relationships. Remember, we in the mission statement in the fifth step column, page 72, it says our mission statement is to get a new attitude, a new relationship with God, and to discover the obstacles in our path. That's what we're doing. And so I've shared with the Hever before. I even suggest we have a new relationship with lust. We see it in a different light. The turnaround for me came when I started seeing lust as a friend and not as a foe. Seeing it more as a warning light rather than something that was to take me down. It was really there. God wired me in such a way not to take me down with lust, but to help me get closer to Him, which in turn builds me up or builds that relationship. It's all about new relationships. So therefore, I'm sharing that with you because ultimately you can have a new relationship with your job as a money manager too, just like Scott has demonstrated. You see?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, Hever, I know where we are on the hour. I'm going to thank Scott personally, really, sincerely, Scott. I've always dreamed of you being on this call. It's a real blessing. We feel all very fortunate. Shrenu, we're all very fortunate that you came, and I know that your words have driven home a lot of the important messages. I've always admired your keen sense to summarize and quote, you know, verse and scripture so easily. It's an impressive demonstration of that. So God should bless you, Scott, to continue to do the work you're doing, the inspiration you do, and the charity work you do as well, which I didn't even go into, which is very numerous. So, yasher koch to you, Scott. Thanks for being on board.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you all for including me.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Yes, I'm going to stop the recording now, if you'll allow me. Hold on, please.